right, everyone. Welcome to an episode of Nationals 101, a podcast for Nationals fans by Nationals fans. My name is Frank, and my wife Susan is not here, which is probably half of you have turned off the podcast already on that news. But she will be in future episodes. She's just out tonight, and we wanted to try a little bit something different, some slightly different formatting on the show, try and expand and grow. So as such, I've brought in two experts in the field of Nationals baseball, or at least as close to experts as anybody can be. First, live from Baltimore, we have T-Clip Specs. Stuart, you there?
Hello.
Hey. We also have SC Via DC. That's Jared Kobe, new proud father from the state of South Carolina, who has been doing a lot of our statistical writing here on the webpage. So if you've been reading some of those excellent posts, he's the one that's doing it. How you doing, Jared?
I'm doing good, Frank.
All right. So thank you very much for being on the show, both you guys. So like I said, what we wanted to do with the podcast is we wanted to try and get a couple of different voices in here. We feel like, you know, Susan and I have definitely felt like we've learned a lot about baseball doing a lot of this stuff. And now it's time to get new people with different ideas involved and to just sort of expand the discussion a bit. And I think that we haven't had either one of you guys on the show before. So why don't I'll tell you what, Jared, you go first. Why don't you tell me, give me like a sentence that you think encapsulates kind of what you think, when you think of the Nats this year and any aspect of them you want, what's something that when you first think of the Nats, what comes to mind?
Failure to live up to expectations.
Okay.
That's, I think for the first couple of months of the season, that's really what they were being judged against. You know, they were supposed to be, you know, out of the gate, they were supposed to be a great team. You know, I think, you know, the expectation of a 100-win season was there, and they just muddled along. They trudged through the mud for the first 3 months of this year, and it just, they couldn't live up to what everybody thought they were going to be.
Stu, what do you think?
I think 2013 was just kind of a manifestation of 2012 being the year about kicking their coverage. Lots of good things already in place. Lots of guys well ahead of schedule. Lots of surprises. But also one of those surprises being not a lot of injuries. So, and well, 2013 has been full of them. So I think that's what I look back on 2013 and the rest of this week kind of with that in mind, just kind of looking back and saying, you know, if we had the luck of 2012 as far as injuries, we'd be in a lot better shape. But at the same time, 2012 was a bit of an aberration and an anomaly for us in general, in terms of the Royal We, the Nats. That's kind of annoying. My apologies.
That's okay.
But as far as just, you know, looking at things from that side of the ledger, injuries really killed us, like Jared said.
Yeah, I think that you were, you're both hitting on, I think, the one thing that everyone can sort of agree on, and that's, it's kind of one of the lead points of one of my upcoming articles. I have an article in the tank. Now, nobody here on this podcast, of course, is writing the Nationals off, because there is still the outside half-street miracle that could happen. But there is still a sort of amount of disappointment that comes with the season, kind of no matter how it finishes up. And I've wrestled with this question a lot, is were the 2012 Nats like a 90-win team that won 8 more games than they should have? And is this going to end up being like a 92-win team that, you know, the 2013 team? That's kind of, I look at this team and I still don't like, as a healthy team, I don't see how that they are worse than the 2012 Nationals. I really don't see places where they're, I think the bullpen, they certainly didn't perform as well, but I just, out of 100 times, you would think that a season like this would happen 5 times maybe, where they sort of completely kind of drop the ball. So I feel like this is going to end up being like a 92-win team that actually is only going to end up winning 86 games or something. And the question going forward is, is this a panic? Like, if you're Mike Rizzo, do you think that the team is going to go continue to kind of be about here, or was it really more about injuries? Stu. You were talking about injuries. I mean, how much do you think that the injuries kind of cost the team this year?
It cost the season, essentially. I was just thinking about what you were saying, and the little bits and pieces I did for Citizens of Nastown for the preview. You know, at mm-hmm. the end of the preview, they said, okay, who wins, who's Rookie of the Year, and all that kind of jazz. And I was thinking back to that, and I was like, wait a minute, what did I have? And I think I had the Nats at 95 wins, and I think that's where they would have been without any of the significant injuries that you saw, you know, especially with Ramos and Harper in particular. Right. And Espinosa up to a point. So I think that's, you know, pretty much on par with what they were without injuries. But looking forward to 2014, I don't think Rizzo really has a whole lot to worry about. I mean, it's what you see is what you get, which is very uncommon in you know, going from year to year, especially with a team of this caliber. Aside from maybe a backup catcher and a starting pitcher, you know, you're still in pretty good shape.
Do you think, Jared, you were doing a lot of the podcast. You've written a bunch of posts for us about, I think I had asked early in the beginning of the year, like, what was the likelihood that a team as good as the Nationals were supposed to be would sweep a team as bad as the Marlins were supposed to be, like all 18 games? And you sort of pointed out it would happen once every 1,000 years. If we did that, do you think that, I understand that, you know, we don't have our binomial distribution right in front of us. I might be putting you on the spot, but what do you think as far as, percentage wise, a team like this underperforming? I mean, was this an anomalous year, or was this a kind of more, what am I trying to say? Do you think this year was an anomaly or not?
Well, if we're looking at how, if we go with the attitude that 2012 was also an anomalous year, you know, I think they outperformed, like Stu said, that they outkicked their coverage last year. But maybe this year, you know, if they can clean up the first 4 months of the year, maybe they get back to, you know, 88, 90 wins where we would expect them to be. Whereas, you know, the last couple months of this season, they've played really well, although the competition wasn't all that great. But they played much better at the end of the year. So if we can extrapolate those last 2 months for the whole year, then maybe we're up to that. So maybe this year is more the bottom edge of the range, when last year was more the high end of the range. So, you know, if we're an 88 win, or if we're an 86 or 87 win team this year, then, you know, maybe we're looking at a 92, 93 win team.
And that's still only right in the hunt with everyone else. 92, 93 wins is, you know, that's a playoff team, but it's you know, not even necessarily an NL East team with how well the Braves sort of performed. They sort of had those couple of hot streaks sandwiched between a lot of 500 baseball. So I feel like that's good. Certainly, I mean, all those games that they played against the Braves this year, they were very, like, they were all one-run games. They were all two-run games tops, really, other than I think one or two. I never got the feeling like the Braves were all that much better than the Nationals, but they just sort of seemed to be clicking in ways that the Nats weren't. And do you guys have a point at which you think the season really kind of turned? I've been looking at July, where they got all their guys back, and they got to within four games of Atlanta, and then went 2-5 against Philly and Miami before the break, and then right after the break they kind of went 0-6, and by the end of the month they were 11 out. So I felt like, even though they had played really terrible baseball up until then, that sort of month where they were trying to refigure out, like, everybody was sort of on their, like, second spring training or third or fourth spring training, they sort of kind of all kind of, that's where they lost it.
Yeah, for me it was probably June and the West Coast swing. And, of course, Harper's injury in L.A., I think that kind of signaled the demise. That's the start of the demise. Was Espinosa even on the team by then? I don't think so.
No, he – because I just
– Syracuse by then.
Yeah, I had written that post about the one that I posted this weekend about the batting averages under different months and with different people mm-hmm. and whether they were injured. There was only 10 games where the team was healthy and had Danny Espinoza in the lineup.
That's right.
And so they were all in the beginning of the year, and by the end of May, he was pretty much gone. So,
he was gone, yeah.
And then they didn't get anybody else back till the end of June. So,
right.
And the strange thing was May and June, they were batting. I mean, their WOBA was like in the 180s, and they played sort of almost 500 baseball, which was just miraculous as far as I was concerned. I couldn't fathom without going back to look how they did it. But,
right.
Yeah. Okay, let's let me see here. I'm going to pull up some of the questions we have from Twitter. We'll talk about some other things too, but let's kind of go here to what some of these people were asking about. Speaking of Danny Espinoza, we have a question about Danny Espinoza from Stephanie. She's kind of half joking because she adds the "I'll hang up and listen." But what is Danny Espinoza thinking? Do we have any theories about where Danny Espinoza's head is at? Jared, I'm going to start with you because I know your dad has a Danny Espinoza jersey that he was very upset that sort of it was like a big deal for him. Like he broke down and he got one and then Danny Espinoza broke
and
down.
And then Danny Espinoza fell apart. Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, no one here is a doctor. So we can't like look inside his shoulder, but I don't know. There was talk about him playing in the Arizona Fall League. Do you have any theories as to why Danny Espinoza seems to A, willfully not be getting healthy, and B, not playing any better?
I don't have any theories. other than the guy wants to avoid having surgery, that's the only thing I could think of.
But... Right. Do you think it's possible that he's actually that scared of surgery?
No. Or... I don't have an MD at the end of my name, but I do have some clinical experience. But so with the rotator cuff, if it was a partial thickness tear, those typically don't need surgery.
Okay.
So I can see where he would be a little remiss to want to go under the knife and say, you know, that, and at least at that point in time, way back in April, May time, he was still fighting for a spot. He was still on the team. He was still thinking, you know what, I can still scrap together some productivity. So let me just hold out the wrist as well. If I remember correctly, the bone that he fractured doesn't typically require surgery. So he could have just been waiting it out and just saying, all right, you know what, I'll just play through it.
Okay.
But having said all that, you do get to a point where you have to say to yourself, all right, this isn't working with normal PT routines, non-surgical, you know, approaches to treatment. Hey, maybe I should, you know, and especially at that point he was, you know, negative 1.5 wins above replacement or something silly yeah. like that, you know, after 2 months of baseball. Where do you draw the line as a player? And I remember talking to a surgeon up in Boston who does Tufts, the teams and things like that. So he's kind of in the loop as far as like the athlete mind and things like that. And also, he knows some people in the Red Sox as well, as I recall. And there's a lot of just athlete stigma of getting an MRI or an X-ray because what's it going to show? Will it show the fracture? Okay, yeah. Will it show something else that may, you know, send up another red flag to the team saying, this guy is really hurt. Hmm. This guy isn't, you know, maybe we should reconsider this player. So I could see where Espinosa's thinking that, like, okay, I already know I have a torn rotator cuff. If I get another MRI, if I get another X-ray, what else is it going to show? What else can the Nats use against me?
Right, kind of like a Henry Rodriguez situation where he sort of knew. I guess he didn't know that he had bone chips, but he knew that his arm was hurt last year.
Right,
and he didn't want to tell anybody.
Yeah, and you're already struggling for a roster spot. You're already struggling with your, you know, your approach and your batting average and everything like that. So I could see where he just became, you know, just kind of put blinders on and went on from there. But at what point do you go, okay, my way isn't working? Let me talk to these and think, you know, consider these professional opinions and move from there. You know, so because think about how much time he wasted, not only his but the team's.
Yeah. And so. Money. I mean, if you wanted to, you know, ultimately it's probably going to have cost him money, because from what I understand that, you know, it, again, maybe the team didn't want him to have surgery, but, you know, if he had gone and said, all right, I need to get this stuff done and I could have it looked at, you know, that's all injury reserve time that you accrue, you know, major league service time for that. So, you know, all, now you're a completely different, in a completely different arbitration position than you were later, which is a very cynical way to look at baseball, I know, but, you know, I mean, well, money's money when you're playing, when you're doing this for a living, you know, money's money.
Yep. And actually the surgeon, I had the chance to chat with, he brought up Mike Napoli.
Yeah.
You know? And with his, you know, the necrotic hip, avascular necrosis, if I remember correctly. Yeah. And, you know, just getting an MRI, what am I going to find? What's, how many millions am I going to lose with this MR scan?
Right.
Yeah. And I could see where there maybe there's a layer of that, or several layers of that with Espinosa, where, you know, maybe he didn't get the right, maybe his handlers didn't give him the right information, or just kind of said, hey, stick it out. He just flat out didn't listen to them and said, I got this.
Yeah.
When in reality, he didn't.
All right. There was a couple questions about the bullpen too. I guess one of the two things, you know, one way is looking forward and saying, hey, do the Nationals need somebody? And then the other way is, you know, looking back and saying, okay, you know, whether adding Soriano was the right move or not. That was a question somebody directly had. And also how the 7th and 8th and 9 can be handled. Certainly, you know, you have Drew Storm, you have Tyler Clippard, somebody's namesake on this podcast, or Twitter namesake anyway, and who's sort of been, I mean, frankly, having a baller year. He's just sort of kind of cruising, you know. Storn's kind of come back and looked a lot better. Soriano's sort of been my least favorite of the three, but he's, you know, you can't say that he hasn't had innings where he's gotten out of them. He has racked up a 40-plus saves, which, even though they're not great stats, do indicate that you did get three people out and finished a game. Do you think that there is questions about the bullpen going forward, and do you think it's maybe a different part of the bullpen? I'll throw this open, whoever wants to answer first, or whoever has thoughts first.
Well, to me, the back end of the bullpen guys haven't really been the problem. I mean, Soriano has had his struggles, but I think that's just what you're going to get with him. He's next year, I mean, I'm pretty sure that his fastball velocity's been, or his velocities on his pitches has been going down, but you know, he's just getting older, so that might be a concern for next season. But it's the other middle relief guys that I think would be where they would need to look. I mean, I haven't had good feelings about, you know, Abad. Although, I mean, if Tanner Roark doesn't make the rotation, maybe he fits in there somewhere. But
right.
It's really the middle of the 5th or 6th innings that I'm more worried about from the bullpen standpoint.
It's like a Ryan Matthews and a Abad and maybe a Xavier Cedeno and a what's Ian Kroll gonna do kind of stuff. Is that what you're?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I haven't been particularly impressed with the guys that we've used this season in those spots. So, I mean, some of them aren't even on the team anymore.
Which, right.
So that's but that's part of my lingering impression of, you know, the bullpen. So
Stu?
I agree. A lot of it's gonna be middle relief, you know, and just how they're handled. I think Ohlendorf is gone. And yeah. I think a lot of how Ohlendorf was handled this year had a trickle-down effect on guys like Storn and Clippard and Soriano, just because he was back and forth. You know, he was a middle relief guy, and then he was a spot starter. And then, of course, you know, he had his issues as far as losing velocity and having to take some time off to kind of get his arm to bounce back. Was surprisingly... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to ask you to elaborate, just, you know, in case there's somebody kind of new listening and not really following, like, okay, so this guy's got moved around a lot. How did that affect the back end, per se?
Sure. So with Ohlendorf moving into a starter's role, those middle innings, those fourth, fifth, sixth, sometimes seventh innings, where you're looking for a guy to kind of bridge the gap between your starter, who the Nationals have a great stable of very good starters, bridging that gap to get to just not really tax your bullpen and say, all right, you know what, Strasburg, Gonzalez, Zimmerman, we'll get seven from you, we'll get the eighth from either Clipper or Storen, and then when the ninth will be Soriano or Storen, you know.
Right.
But with him moving to the starter role and having his issues, he can only go four or five innings. So where are we going to get those other three innings or so of arm, you know, for
gotcha.
Lack of a better word? And that's where Kroll comes into play. That's where moving Clipper up to the seventh and stretching out Storen in the eighth comes into play. That's where Soriano pitching three, four consecutive days comes into play.
Right. Especially right after he, you know, Davey says we can't pitch him 4 days in a row. That was that series against the Giants at home. And, you know, he rolled the dice again and, you know, got caught. So.
Exactly. And then, you know, come in and, again, injuries rear their ugly head. You know, even though it was a a self-imposed injury.
Right.
Ryan Matthews breaking his hand. You know,
old punch a locker. Yeah.
Guy. And he was, you know, he was nails last year. And he's a lot like Storen. He's finally come around and has become nails again, but, you know, a little too late.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's where, you know, a guy like Matthews and Ohlendorf come into play. You know, you have your sixth, seventh inning squared away. You have your back end three well-rested, and you can, and that actually allows you to have a little more freedom as far as matchups.
Right.
You know, you don't always have to say, all right, Storen, here's the eighth for you. You can go, hey, does he need a break? Does he not fare well against these particular hitters? All right, we can put in, you know, a bod instead or whatever. So
yeah,
just a lot of the flexibility was lost with Ohlendorf moving to the starting rotation, and it just kind of trickled down from there. Just stretching guys that really shouldn't have been throwing the innings that they did, and then really overworking guys that should have been kept in a particular role.
Right, that's going to cost a guy like Ohlendorf his, you know, whatever little velocity he had, because I remember, I think I was at the game in Detroit when he sort of had his tired arm, and it wasn't pretty. I mean, you could see it from the stands. It was just, he was laboring to throw the ball in a spot where he had 5 days rest, but he was sort of exhausted. Yeah. I do think that the bullpen, I mean, I think that they waited too long to get rid of guys like Zach Duke and Henry Rodriguez. I was a very big Henry supporter. I really wanted him to pull it together, but he never did. But they had sort of guys in there that were sort of, you know, really bad. And then they had a nice little renaissance kind of right around June and July when they were bringing up these younger arms that nobody had really seen before. At least you were kind of seeing something different, a little more energy out of the bullpen, a little more, a little something different. You know, they were kind of catching some of the guys by surprise because there wasn't much tape on them.
Not to be confused with the Dan Heron Renaissance.
No, there were several Renaissance throughout the year.
A different Renaissance there. Yes.
The Dan, we'll get to the Dan Heron Renaissance. Maybe not today, because I feel like the season should be over before I make my full-throated apology. And not saying I'm sorry, but argument in favor of Dan Heron. Argument in favor of the idea that while he was bad this year, he wasn't as bad as everyone thought he was.
Yes.
But that's a subtle point, and this is not a subtle world. The side question with the bullpen is, and Susan and I had talked about this last week, or the last week, last time we did a podcast last month, was that there's a lot of people who, at least amongst our peers, maybe not baseball managers yet, but who don't necessarily think that, you know, your closer should be your best pitcher, that your best relief pitcher should be out facing the best part of the batting order towards the end of the game. Certainly this is a Tom Tango idea. Do you think that? I think it's sort of worked out that way, because I do think Tyler Kluppert has been the best pitcher at the back end. I just think that Rafael Soriano changes his entire stance based on whether he has a closing, a saving opportunity or not. So I think it's pretty clear that you know, he's not really interested in pitching unless it's going to affect his contract bonuses, which, you know, more power to him. But do you think that going forward, maybe next year, they'll switch that order a little, or do you think they should switch that order a little? Anybody, Jared, do you, any thoughts on whether, you know, Storen, Clippard, Soriano should be the order, if it should be a different order, or will that depend on who the manager is?
I think it will depend a lot on who the manager is. I mean, I'm related to Reds fans, and they complain up and down about how Dusty Baker uses his bullpen. So just the other day, you know, when the Reds and the Astros played into the 13th inning, and you know, Chapman didn't come in until it was a save situation, which, you know, if you're trying to extend the game, isn't going to work out as well. I mean, if one of your other lesser relievers gives up a run in, you know, the bottom of the 10th, and you never got to have a save situation, then you did use your best reliever.
Right.
So,
and I believe Zach Duke is on that team, as if I remember. So, you know, there was
he pitched in that game too, and if you know, Jose Altuve doesn't try and go from first to third on a, you know, a single to left with a runner in front of him that got held up at third, then maybe the Astros actually win that game. But, you know, Zach Duke did pitch. He tried to give the game away, I think. But but so I think a lot of it will depend on the thinking of, you know, who the new manager is, what their baseball philosophy is. And it'll probably come down to how things go in April and May next year too, you know.
Yeah. And who's available and who's, I mean, yeah, I guess who they bring in, I guess, or who they don't bring in for middle relief. Stu, do you have any thoughts on either the philosophy of closers or the Nats in specific that you want to share?
Sure. So being up in Baltimore, see a lot of Oriole games, and kind of going on what Jared said, you know, the Orioles are kind of in a different boat in some respects compared to the Reds, and their manager, Buck Showalter, he likes to play percentages, he likes to play, it's a little more of an unconventional fashion, and just thinking about an extra inning game they just had against the Rays, he kind of went against what he typically does and play the hot hand or just play the right matchup, and he kept his closer, Jim Johnson, out of the game, even though there's probably a handful of situations where, you know, looking back, you think, you know what, instead of Bud Norris, maybe we should have brought in Jim Johnson. So just an interesting aside. Just going back to what he was saying, it's going to be very manager-dependent. But at the same time, I agree that, you know, I think you put your best pitcher into a game for the situation at hand.
Right.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that that doesn't necessarily require Soriano to pitch the ninth. Although you do have kind of more of a psychological or cultural aspect of baseball, and, you know, these guys are, you know, Soriano and even Storen have said, you know, they're there for the ninth.
Right.
They close. Well, when do you close? You don't close in the seventh inning.
Right.
Even though that may be the highest leverage inning of a particular game, and you want your best pitcher there. And if that's Storen, there you go. If that's Soriano, there you go. Move him there. But you'll never see guys like that, because it's the saves and the holds. Well, not so much the holds. The saves in particular are, you know, your salary is hinged upon how many you
right.
have. So. And you can't get a save in the seventh, so, well, there you go.
I would love for them to rewrite contracts, you know, and just...
Yeah.
We would have to start, like, I mean, but now you have kids who are pitching in Little League and high school who are, you know, just finding out that maybe they won't be starters, but they've got some stuff, and it's like, hey, I'm going to be a closer now, you know? And, like, that's, like, I'm guessing that a lot of middle relief guys are sort of guys who weren't closer, who couldn't be closers and who couldn't be starters, but, you know... Guys who can't be starters, probably their next, you know, desire is to be a closer because of how we view baseball. But That's probably not going to happen anytime soon, so I won't hold my breath. If it's a very manager-dependent decision, do you guys have thoughts or ideas about who you want to be manager? I know I've been pretty vocal that I don't really like Randy Knorr as a manager, and not even so much based on anything I've seen him, based on anything that I've seen as far as his managerial style. Like I think he's won the two games he's been the interim manager for this year when Davey disappeared. But he's done a couple of things that were kind of weird. Like, I didn't like how he called out Harper. I thought he sort of, like, there was no need for him to get thrown out the other night. I felt like I was watching that game, and it didn't look like the umpire or another player was about to get tossed. It looked like Randy Knorr just sort of stepped in, and he sort of seems to have a couple of comments here and there, and I haven't liked the fact that I felt like he's been politicking for the job, which, of course, is a completely emotional response and reason not to like him for manager, but that's part of what I don't like. But do you guys have a... It'd be impossible to say who do you think's going to be the manager, because, you know, that question's completely wide open right now. Do you have ideas about a manager you'd like to see, or you think is possible, or anything? Hoping for? Wish list?
Jared, sure.
Oh, Jared's shaking his head no, so...
I'll throw it out there. I'm slightly against you as far as Knorr. I think he would be a decent hire.
Controversy. I like it.
I know. Boo. I think the Nats in general are a very young team, and whoever takes over the helm is going to have to be the right mix of mentor, psychologist, cheerleader, tough love provider. For the younger players that Davey probably wasn't. That's where you have guys like Adam LaRoche and Jason Worth kind of stepping in and going, hey, you're overstepping your boundaries. This isn't how you do this up here in the show kind of thing.
Right.
And I think that's where Knorr has an advantage, just because he's familiar with the organization. He's been, he's coached there forever. He's coached a lot of these guys. So I could see where he may have an advantage there. The only downside to a guy like that, or even, he hasn't talked about a lot, but a guy like Tony Beasley down in AAA Syracuse.
Yeah.
Even Trent Jewett, he has managerial experience, at least in the minor leagues, at AAA, again, with the Chiefs. But I could see where that's, it might behoove the front office to go for a guy like that, more so than a Charlie Manuel.
Right.
Just kind of says, kind of rolls the ball out and says, all right, boys, go get it,
Yeah, I feel like we just had that manager,
it sounds kind of familiar, kind of eerily familiar.
Right.
But again, that's kind of where my thoughts are, and that doesn't necessarily mean it has to be someone from the Nats organization, but we'd love Bo Porter, but it's
yeah.
It won't happen.
Yeah, I was just going to say, a lot of people have asked about Bo Porter, and my response is that if they really liked Bo Porter, they would have told him that last year, and they would have maybe said, if there was real mutual interest there. I don't think they disliked Bo Porter, but I think that if you're going to, when he would say something like, hey, I'm going to go be the manager of the Astros unless you got something for me, then I think they would have said, well, we'll just hire you now and let you know as soon as Davey's done, you're the next manager. I think they kind of knew him well enough to make that determination last year, so I don't think they're going to go chase him now.
And it's one of those situations where, from what I've read and understood, the Astros job, as funny as it sounds, was Bo Porter's dream job.
Yeah.
And that's why you're not going to see him. And obviously there's contractual stipulations.
Sure. Yeah.
That
it would cost
whoever,
him. Yeah.
Whoever coaches him, yeah. Potentially, they would have to pay over King's ransom to take him.
I think Red Porch Report did like a poll, and they included a lot of names that were being thrown around, which included Mattingly and Girardi, which is always like because they live in LA and New York, so they're always just about to get fired. And then they had the guy from Arizona, and
Matt Williams.
Yep, and which I think everybody who talks about him talks very highly of him, and it's always people I kind of admire. So I didn't have any real problem with that. And then they have, of course, the weird Cal Ripken Jr. rumor that I can't tell if Cal started himself or if just somebody at Masson started. But it just sort of like he showed up one day and then all of a sudden, you know, all the Phil Wood callers, you know, were like, hey, let's do it. Joe Gibbs too. And Cal, here we go. And, you know, I don't see what the problem is. And you're either for us or against us, which we don't need to rehash the Cal Ripken Jr. discussion unless anybody wants to, because it's fun. It really gets people upset. If anybody wants to say anything negative about Cal Ripken Jr. now, you can say so on my podcast, even though he was my favorite player growing up. I don't know. If a guy like Joe Girardi does get fired, I would hope they would at least talk to him, because he's done nothing but good things everywhere he's went, including the Marlins, where his one losing season, he won manager of the year. Because they were supposed to win about 20 games and he won 78 or something. I don't know. I mean, that's good stuff about Randy Nohr. You're right. He might be that type of mix, that right type of mix for those type of players. But you'd hope that Rizzo or whoever gets the right guy in there. Jared, you sure you don't have any thoughts about who you'd like to see manager? Be a manager?
Yeah, I don't. Managers are not really something I tend to focus on. So
there you go.
I don't really have a whole lot of expertise on, you know, who's out there and who would be a good fit.
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, other than I would like to see the team go in a different direction than what we got this season.
Right.
I would like something different, but I wouldn't. Want somebody completely green either. So.
Yeah. Do either of you think Davey cost the team games this year? He really put like Chad Tracy into a lot of games, and I know he had to put him into some of them, but there were times where I was wondering why a particular pitcher would come in and not just. No, never mind. I'm nitpicking now. I don't want to do that. But if anybody has any concrete reasons as to why they think Davey Johnson might have cost him some games, you can speak if you'd like. But I don't know. I was just going to say I definitely felt like he checked out by the end of July. There were times in August where I was like, he just seemed to be, you know, in his radio interviews and whatnot, he definitely seemed to be sort of whatever. I'm almost done now. I had that sort of feeling from him, but I can't remember anything concrete, so I don't want to really stake my reputation on it right now.
I think one of the biggest things about Davey, which is one of the reasons why players love playing for him, and which is another reason why some players don't, if you're a veteran, you're his guy. And I think that's you see that a lot with Chad Tracy.
Yeah.
Obviously, Chad Tracy is there to do one thing, and that's hit a home run, and it hasn't happened very often, maybe three times so far this year. But that's kind of where a lot of his decisions became pretty robotic, you know? Who's the veteran? Okay, there we go. There's our answer.
Right.
And even when it came down to injuries and, you know, going back to Espy, not to hum on Danny Espinosa, but, you know, hey, he's my guy in here. He tells me he's not hurting. Okay. And even with Harper, even though he isn't a veteran per se, he has that veteran presence almost and the respect of a veteran, and that's where, you know, Davey is, he's loyal to a fault, and I think that's what we saw this year is the fault of that.
Yeah, he stuck with a lot of guys a lot. You know, Espinosa in the field for a long time, and it's, of course, you know, you're not jumping all over him. It's very easy, I think we all understand, it's very easy to say that now in September and say, hey, what were you doing back in May letting him play? But that question keeps getting brought up. I mean, how many times did he send Henry out there or Zach Duke out there? And certainly definitely people would say that about Dan Heron. And, you know, it paid off in some respects. He definitely got some guys to kind of come back and, you know, it worked sticking it out with some of these guys. Definitely Harper too. You know, Harper was really hurt. And I understand the prospect of, like, you know, replacing him, you know, even a week more than they did is probably painful. But who knows, if he does it a little quicker, maybe it doesn't cost as much overall. That's one of those impossible questions to answer at this point. But yeah, he definitely had like a default mode that sort of seemed to be almost formulaic. Like you could just sort of point to something on the chart and say, okay, it's this point up and I need this type of guy. And I'm just going to, you're right. It was always, you know, Chad Tracy here and X guy there and whatnot. Lombardozzi here every third day, you know, or switch hitting and, you know, not using Scott Harrison in more platooning situations and whatnot. And it took him a long time to move Denard Span down into the, down in the lineup, which you could argue maybe he should have done a little sooner just to kind of figure out what the hell was going on. Bring Moore up quicker to see if he could kind of platoon LaRoche. That's actually another question. Do you think that LaRoche has 1 year left on his deal? Do you think that a Tyler Moore, Adam LaRoche platoon is a good idea in 2014? Or do you think that LaRoche will have the starting job? Or Moore this year sort of, you know, had his chance to start with. He certainly was on the team. Didn't cotton to the bench very well at first.
Well, I mean, if it is a platoon with LaRoche, how does that affect his normal, I don't start hitting until late May kind of start?
Adam LaRoche's.
That would be my question, is, you know, he doesn't hit for a long, it takes him a while to get into the groove of the season, and then he gets on, goes on a hot streak, but he's been a historical slow starter. So how's that affect him and his batting? And, you know, can, in a platoon, does Tyler Moore get enough playing time to be able to hit like he has recently? Because it's more, I think when he went down to Syracuse and got to play every day, that was what he needed to have happen. But, and as you said, when he was on the bench, he did not do much. So, you know, what's, if it is a platoon, what's the balance of playing time that they need to get both of those guys going?
Because you could probably break both of them if you don't handle them right, or maybe there's not a way to balance that.
Yeah.
Let's see, what else do we have here?
I had a thought about.
Well, then you should share it.
Very well. I will answer that with a, once Moore and Storen went down to Syracuse to kind of figure things out, they really put on a good show. One that may predicate them being trade bait, and one that would put LaRoche right where he's at to see through the rest of his contract, and would possibly bring back a starter, something along those lines, another prospect. But I don't see the platoon happening, is basically what I'm trying to say.
Gotcha. Yeah, there's a couple of guys who are going to be in that weird, just tradable enough kind of position, I think, going into the offseason, which is something maybe in a couple of weeks you guys will come back on. We'll talk about, you know, wait till the season's over. We'll talk about stuff that like that afterwards. But I think there might be stuff there to cull. We have a question from Hobie Dog, who wants to know if the Nats should pick up a bat dog. Since it's working well for Trenton, which I don't know the name of the Trenton minor league team, but if they have a bat dog, that's pretty
Thunder.
Cool. The Thunder. I would have got, that was my guess. But I felt like Trenton Thunder was almost a hockey team name, but, okay. The Trenton Thunder baseball team, but I will parlay Hobie's question into a different question. Do either of you guys, and this, and both of you guys have moved away, so maybe you don't have as many, thoughts about Andy Pfeffer or the leaving of Andy Pfeffer and the, but you still get all the Natitude commercials and stuff. What do you think of the Andy Pfeffer? What do you think of the recent marketing done by the Nationals in the last 3 or 4 years? Do you think that Andy Pfeffer left a good mark on the Nats? Or do you think that there's certainly plenty of people who are very grumpy about Natitude and the like, and the sort of, you know, but a lot of the people tend to also be the people who don't like anything going on between innings.
really?
Luigi. Yeah. Luigi. Yeah. He'll admit it. It's fine.
You know. He's good.
But I thought he did an okay job. I thought Take Back the Park Night was a bit ridiculous, but it did exactly what it was supposed to do. It got everybody like angry at the Phillies and excited about playing baseball, you know, and maybe winning a game finally against the freaking Phillies. I thought, he, you know, as far as like a carnival, once you accept the idea that he's a carnival barker, I think he did a very good job as a carnival barker. I guess that's my opinion of him.
I think the fact that you knew his name,
yeah,
probably tells you everything you need to know. It's almost like an offensive line or even an umpire. If you know their names, if you can point them out and go, "Hey, Angel Hernandez," they're probably doing something wrong. And that was kind of the feeling I got from Zephyr. I mean, it seemed like for probably the things that we'll never hear about, the 100 things that he just, you know, was spot on with, it's the one or two that just completely tanked and put him into the, you know, put him in the WAPO and things like that. It's like, oh, man, you know?
Right.
So I see it like that. I almost see it as like the Jim Bowden era.
Okay.
You know.
Right. Jim Bowden did a couple of good things, but everyone's going to remember that he signed a guy who lied about his age. And
exactly. They're going to remember the leather pants and Segway. They're not going to remember the guy that was a great scouting eye and did a lot of good things. And, you know, they're just going to remember the crap. And it's unfortunate. And it just kind of goes back to, you know, if you're doing your job as an umpire or an offensive lineman or, you know, the head of marketing or whatever, you know, you're not really seen or heard from. So.
Right.
But yeah, that's my take.
Jared, how did you feel about Natitude? Give us some thoughts about the passing of the Natitude era.
Well, you know, what will really fix any, what makes the marketing easier is winning. So, you know.
True.
I think Natitude got a pass because when it came out they won. So, you know, if it had been another 100 loss season with Natitude, I think everybody's attitude about it would have been completely different. So, you know,
it would have been more like expect it, right? With the
yes,
I agree, because I remember when it first came out, there was a lot of backlash to Natitude, and then because we were all winning and experiencing joy, everything's a lot easier to, you know. I guess that it's that spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down. But you know, hey, I'll give this to Pfeffer. That stupid Lipton Do the Wave thing that never showed up at Nationals Park, even though that was some sort of promotion that they started this year with MLB. And Terrence is a good guy. He totally is, you know, he doesn't like the wave, which is, I'm a single issue voter. That's it. If you are anti-wave, I am pro you. And, no, that's not true. But you know, whatever. Totally. You're right. I think he was in charge during the Nationals era, the misspelled jerseys and some of the other stuff, but he did get some stuff right. So I will dub him the Dan Heron of front office, the Dan Heron of front office marketing, you know, not great, but could have been a lot worse.
As long as the Nationals never use the phrase "stick it to" in one of their commercials, I'll be fine.
That was the Braves, right?
Jerry,
tell the story, because you live in Braves country, so you know. First of all, I'm sorry, but tell the story.
So, all of the Fox Sports networks, I have DirecTV and MLB Extra Innings, so I get to, when I watch other games, I get to see all of the local commercials, which is very hit or miss. It does prove that, you know, car dealerships have the same commercials no matter where you are. But all of the Fox Sports stations have Fox Sports girls that are basically sideline reporters. They're the Julie Alexandrias of the Fox Sports stations.
Okay.
So watching the doubleheader, I guess that was Tuesday.
Yeah, last week's doubleheader, yeah.
Last Tuesday, the doubleheader against the Braves, during one of the commercials, they had their two Fox Sports South girls, and one of them says, you know, Can the Braves stick it to the Nationals one last time? And the other one replies with, "Find out on Sports South." And it was just like, to me, it was like, Did they actually just say that? Did I mishear that? And then it came on again later that day, and Stacy was here. And she was like, yeah, they actually did say that. And so that was run all during both games on Tuesday, but I didn't see it once on Wednesday. So
it has that feel of like the Braves are 14 games up on the Nats, but if we could kick them one more time in the stomach, let's do it, guys. Tune in to find out. But they didn't do that the next day, right? Like, that commercial was missing, wasn't it?
I think
that was the punchline was after the Nats took the two in the doubleheader, that commercial disappeared.
They had another one where they said that the Braves had dominated the Nationals all season, which was much more along the lines of, you know, how the Masson commercials put up all the stats for, for whoever's coming into town next,
right.
Whoever we're facing next there's that play, but it was, they had won for, like, but that one didn't bother me less because, it was true. The Braves had owned us all season, so there isn't much I could. But the phrase "stick it to" it just bothered me to no end.
It seemed a little like if somebody had said that on the other team, I think Brian McCann or Chris Johnson would have gotten into that marketing person's face, and there might have been a fight.
Yeah,
because hey, they're the arbiters of what's okay and not in baseball now that they're winning. Mm-hmm. Well, the funny thing about those Masson commercials too, and then we'll wrap it up. But I have to get one last joke in. The funny thing about those Masson commercials all year is that they're clearly like made like 3 weeks in advance, because they're at least twice this year they would have a stat that would say, Gio Gonzalez, he has a 1.27 ERA against the Twins or whatever, right? And 27 strikeouts in two games. And then they would talk about, another person. But whenever they did that, there was at least twice where that player was not going to be in the lineup against the team. And twice it was a pitcher, which is like, come on, guys, we can all count by five. Like, there's no way Gio Gonzalez was pitching against the Twins or whoever the team was at that time. And then another one was, I think, like Harper during his, like, 2 month long, exodus into Injuryville was sort of he hit 379 and with three home runs against Team X, and he's not coming back till July, so I didn't feel very good about the promo in either case. So hopefully that'll get better under whoever does Masson next year. Yeah,
but the question is, does that come through Nationals? Is that controlled by the Nationals, or is that actually done by Masson? In which case, they won't care.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, maybe it was a dirty Peter Angelos thing where he just sort of said, "Let's really stick it to him," like the day that the Orioles Twitter account tweeted out that the Braves had swept the Nats, and because allegedly the MLB guy at the front office got the passwords wrong or forgot to log out of his other account. I believe that. I expect, Stu, you live in Baltimore. I expect you to figure this out for the next time we chat.
I'll get down to it.
All right. Do you guys have any parting thoughts about the last week of the season? Anything you guys want to share? We're going to wrap it up here. But, there's still six games to play. And whether they, whether some ridiculous miracle happens or not, there's still a chance that a very outside chance at a 90-win season. Certainly, a chance to get in the high 80s. I've been sort of, personally, there's no way you can't be disappointed based and compared to where you started the season, but I feel like I'm really encouraged and happy with how they've sort of finished out the season, even though it was against some weaker teams. And I'm looking forward to them to kind of one way or the other, trying to win these two series on the road. It'd be nice to kind of punch the Cardinals in the nose once and, take a couple from Arizona. Do you guys have any thoughts about the last week of the season, or Jared, anything?
Well, 90 wins is very outside because they have to sweep.
Right.
Now, sweeping the Diamondbacks, that's right on the edge of being, probable. Going 2-1 against the Cardinals is definitely feasible. Other than that, that would get us to 89. I'm expecting, 3-3.
Okay.
Win against the Diamondbacks, lose the series against the Cardinals. But that's just based on the records. They've already accomplished the goal that I set out in my last post, which was to have a winning season. So from here on out, it's just kind of cruising to see where we end up. The chances of the Reds losing as many games as we need them to lose is very slim. I mean, they could get swept by the Pirates, but they're playing at home. If they were going to get swept by the Pirates, it should have been this last series where they were in Pittsburgh. And, you know, we can't expect the Mets to win too many games against the Reds. So, but for the most part, it's just seeing, you know, if the Dodgers can catch the Braves for the, or the Cardinals can catch the Braves for the best record, but we'll have a big play in that. And then, you know, who's going to limp into the AL wild card? That's really my thing for the last week of the season.
Okay. Yeah, the AL wild card's still pretty tight. Stu, do you have any thoughts about the last week of the Nats season? What's likely to be the last week of the Nats season?
Yeah, I think kind of the overarching thought, and actually this was the last point I was hoping to make, like one of the last questions that I kind of wrote down was, you know, we spent a lot of time thinking about what went wrong, and, well, we should think about not only what can still go right in the last week, but what went right overall this season. I mean, just even most recently, in this last month, Denard Span's 29-game hit streak. Strasburg hitting 500 Ks quicker than only a handful of people, with only a handful of people getting to 500 Ks quicker than him.
Right.
Ian Desmond, another 2020 season. Five guys with 20 or more home runs in the lineup. Obviously, Harper still doing amazing things at his age 20 and 21 seasons, in spite of the injuries. Looking at Ross Detweiler and the development and maturation of him as a starting pitcher, I know, you know, obviously he's kind of fallen by the wayside because of the back injury, but there's a lot to look at this year. And while, yes, it didn't all, you know, sum up to 95 wins in the AL, in the NL East title, but there's still a lot of good things that came out of this season that should still have a lot of people encouraged, not only for the last week and what can possibly happen, but for 2014. And I think, you know, just kind of looking on, you know, and this is probably the worst thing, you know, just worst way to look at it, but just looking at Twitter and just kind of looking at the doom and gloom, and it's like, all right, it's not that bad, guys. You know, as yeah. Nats fans, it's been a lot worse. I mean, 2009, anyone?
2008, you know, so nine, yeah.
back to back winning seasons.
Right.
It's not as bad as it sounds, you know, or as a lot of us make it out to be. And I think that's what the last week should be. You know, hopefully everyone kind of takes a page out of that book and says, all right, what are we still doing well? What can we still do well?
Right.
And then just let the cards fall as they may. It's 0.2%, but hey, yeah, it's still there.
Better than nothing, you know.
It's greater than zero still, but yes, let's look at it as a whole, and it's still a very good, very productive season for the
Astros. Right.
Well, it's hard to look at the last 2 months of the season and not be encouraged for next season. That's
absolutely. It's sort of been a whirlwind, and it really the only question is really sort of it's focused my mind on. Man, if these two teams had, and that's why I wrote this post, because it wasn't really a defensive Rick Eckstein, this last post I wrote. It was more a defensive, you know, look at how good this team can hit when they're healthy, right? And even though the pitching took a kind of step back, it didn't take a huge step back, and it sort of kind of went back to like a normal, like last year's pitching, especially in the first half of the year, was out of this world. It was completely unsustainable levels of great pitching. And so if you look at these last 2 months and you look at this healthy team when they hit, that's really encouraging going forward. Every, you know, especially Zim, you know, I think Ryan Zimmerman started September with 15 home runs and he's over 25 now. He's sort of, you know, he's on a different planet, and sure, there's a matter of like a whole team, like learning not to go cold all at the same time, but there's plenty of things to be encouraged about, especially with a young team. And a lot of these guys, under contract for a while, but this is a subject for another. This is a post-season discussion where we could definitely sort of hand out some grades maybe and talk about, really sit down and say, hey, these are the things that the team did well, and these are the teams that were places where they can improve, and we'll have you guys back. So thank you very much, both of you guys, Jared and Stu, coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Oh, had a blast.
Yeah. Thank you.
We will make a habit of this. And we're going to get Court on this show eventually. He's also a new father, great. But I think his baby's on a different schedule than Jared's baby. So it's going to be tough getting all of us together. But we're going to do that and reach out to some other people. But for now, let me give you some of our contact info. You can find us on Twitter, Nationals101. And on Facebook, facebook.com/Nationals101. You can email us at nationals101@gmail.com. And our podcast is available at our website, nats101.com. It's the only place we're not Nationals101. It's nats101.com. Also on iTunes. You can search Nationals101 on iTunes, and we'll pop up there. And who knows, maybe one day I'll do Spotify or something like that. But for now, I'd like to thank again Jared Kobe and Stu Wallace for coming on and talking baseball and answering a bunch of these questions that we got on Twitter. And we'll do this again, and hope everyone has a nice time. And hey, who knows, maybe miracle of miracles, we'll be talking about the Nats having done something incredibly special. But either way, I hope the last week of the season is a good week for everyone. Thanks very much, and have a good day.